It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, many voters said abortion was one of the top issues that drove them to the polls. We'll take a closer look at the role that reproductive rights played in the midterm elections. First, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources released a draft of a new proposed wolf management plan last week. The agency said some of the main goals of the plan are to ensure a sustainable wolf population and reduce wolf-related conflicts. The DNR is seeking public feedback and input on the draft plan for the next 60 days, and we want to hear your thoughts. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you taken a look at the new proposed wolf management plan? What's your reaction? What questions do you have about the way the state manages gray wolves? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Adrian Wideven is a retired forest wildlife biologist, chair of the Timberwolf Alliance Advisory Council, and assistant co-chair of the wildlife group for Wisconsin's Green Fire. He served on the Wolf Plan Advisory Committee and helped develop previous DNR wolf plans. Adrian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Can you, before we get to this new plan, can you give us the state of wolf management right now? What is the current guideline, the current plan we're operating under in Wisconsin?
So the current plan we're operating on was a plan that was produced in 1999. There were some minor updates done to that plan in 2007, and there were several attempts for running from 2009 through just recently of trying to update that plan, but those efforts didn't lead to an actual new plan until the last 2 years of efforts, and now we are seeing a new plan being proposed.
Now, something that strikes me as different in this draft, I went looking for the number, and it seems like a lot of past plans or proposals have said, you know, here's our target number for the right-ish amount of gray wolves in the state. It seems like this new plan is taking a different approach. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The plan is getting away from numeric goals, and the department is doing more of that with other wildlife as well. Currently, deer management, bear management is less based on an exact numeric goal, but try to decide with the current populations on the landscape whether they need to be stabilized, whether they need to be reduced, or whether they can be allowed to increase. And the department has taken a similar approach now to wolves here as well. And in the zones where they're most suitable, in zones 1, 2, and 5, the department is going to be taking a very careful approach in allowing the population to remain at relatively stable high levels, but perhaps apply more controls in areas where there's more likely to be conflict. So it seems like a good combination.
Can you talk about the balancing act, I guess regardless of zone, but mainly in the main wolf areas in the state, between, as you said, a sustainable on the large side population and a conflict with humans in various ways?
Sure. In areas where there's good areas of wild lands, extensive public lands, wolves perform useful ecological benefits, and having a healthy, stable wolf population on landscape is very useful for those areas. In areas where you've got more highly modified landscape, where there's more more cattle, more livestock, more people living, more pets, there's probably more of a risk of having a conflict. In those areas, we probably want to maintain a lower wolf population. So this plan seems to strike a good balance between allowing healthy populations to maintain on the landscape in the areas of suitable habitat, but keeping the population under more control in areas where there's more mixed habitat or less suitable habitat.
We both use the phrase balancing act here. There are going to be people... Let's start with people concerned that, hey, this plan could mean there are going to be more wolves than I want in my area. I'm worried if I'm a farmer in this area, I'm worried about livestock depredation. What would you say to reassure them that that can be managed at the sort of numbers that targets that the DNR is aiming for here?
Well, I think especially like in some of those kind of situations, it's often localized controls are going to have more of an impact than what the wolf population looks like in a large zone or across the state. So in the case of a farmer having wolf problems, the plan does allow a variety of not lethal and non-lethal techniques once they're off the endangered species list for managing problem wolves within those areas. And there are some areas of concentrated wolf depredations, wolf conflicts that are being designated for maintaining lower wolf populations in those areas. So the department's had now many years of kind of following the wolf population. We kind of know the places where they're going to have problems, and those are some of the areas that have been identified to maintain lower wolf populations. But that represents a relatively small percentage of the overall wolf range in Wisconsin. So it's suggesting that across much of wolf range, their populations can probably be allowed to stabilize or maintain at near current levels. But there are some areas where we may want to have some reductions.
We're talking about gray wolves with Adrian Wideven, longtime wildlife biologist here in the state, now with the Timberwolf Alliance Advisory Council and Wisconsin's Green Fire, looking at a draft plan from the state DNR when it comes to wolf management, gray wolf management in Wisconsin. Goodbye target number on this plan. Hello to different zones around the state, balancing the needs of a sustainable wolf population with possible conflicts with humans. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see in your part of the state? Do you like the idea of trying to have larger populations where appropriate? Do you have concerns about that? Do you have questions about how all this works? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Adrian, let's take a step back now and look at the long-term trajectory of gray wolves in the state. We had 50, 60 years ago? They started moving back in gradually. Give us a little overview of the history.
Sure. So the population was mostly decimated by the end of the 1950s and were considered to be about zero by 1960, and slowly started coming back in the mid-1970s with the state and the Federal Endangered Species Act that provided protection of the Minnesota wolf population, and they started gradually spreading into the state. The Wisconsin DNR started a formal wolf monitoring program in the fall of 1979, and every year since that time have been counting wolves in the state, and that population went from the first year being counted as 25. The most recent estimate was about 972 wolves. So we've seen that population really grow over time from a population just barely making it and now a fairly healthy population that's having ecological impacts on the landscape.
One of the big questions people may be wondering about is, what about hunting wolves? And we've seen via the courts this back and forth, hunts are on, hunts are off. Where do we stand now? How difficult does that make all this for the DNR to plan if they don't know whether a hunting season is going to be allowed, required, or forbidden?
Well, the way hunting would occur in Wisconsin, wolves would have to be off the federal list of endangered species, and currently they are, again, on the federal list of endangered species. The state of Wisconsin, the legislature, has set regulations that when wolves are not on the federal or state endangered or threatened species list, the Wisconsin DNR shall hold a wolf hunting season. And that's what this plan is partially about, is kind of prescribing how those wolf hunting and trapping seasons will be done when wolves are not on the federal list of endangered species. And we expect that with the healthy wolf population in Wisconsin and adjacent areas in Michigan and Minnesota, that they will again be removed from the federal endangered species list and management will again return to the state. So we expect there will be some sort of a hunting season. But this plan does explain how that hunting will be done, the kind of goals the department is planning for the various zones, where the department is going to have very limited impacts on the population, other areas where they might have more controls on the population. And one of the things the department includes in here is having buffer zones around the Indian reservations that provide better protection for those packs living on reservation lands.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Shawnee County. John, hi.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Good. What did you bring up, John?
Well, you guys put these out there, and people have dogs running around. I had two dogs killed. Two of my black labs killed, a female and a male, killed by wolves on the land where they put out their wolves. They just put them out there. So you're telling me this is what happens? I'm walking down the trail, doing something in the woods, and I'm not being attacked.
John, thanks for the call. Sorry for the loss of your dogs. John, this is a concern, Adrian, that people have about their pets, their dogs and cats in particular.
Yeah. Sorry to hear from John as well. And those kind of things do occasionally occur. Of course, wolves are not put on the landscape. Mm-hmm. They've got here on their own. But I can understand when a person's angry and frustrated that often you're going to look for somebody to take the blame for that loss. But that's a situation that occasionally occurs, and the department is working hard to kind of reduce those conflicts and identify those conflicts. If they're off the endangered species list, those wolves would be removed. Currently, the department only has authority to use lethal controls if there's any kind of a human safety situation. And sometimes when dogs are attacked, there may also be perceived a human safety situation where lethal controls would be authorized. But, yeah, there are efforts underway to try to reduce those kind of risks, and that, those are the kind of things the department wants to educate people about.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to longtime forest wildlife biologist, chair of the Timberwolf Alliance Advisory Council, Adrian Wideven, about the latest proposed wolf management plan from the Wisconsin DNR, currently in a comment period. You can comment to us at 800-642-1234. Have you dealt with and or seen gray wolves around Wisconsin? What has been your experience? What would you like to see from the DNR when it comes to managing the wolf population in our state? What questions do you have about the biology, ecology, and management of gray wolves in Wisconsin? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue this conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We pick up our talk now with Adrian Wideven, retired forest wildlife biologist, chair of the Timberwolf Alliance Advisory Council, with us today for a look at the Wisconsin DNR's new proposed wolf management plan. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think Wisconsin should manage its gray wolf population? What do you think of this proposed plan from the DNR? If it's allowed again in Wisconsin, should wolf hunting be allowed, required? What should the limits be on that? Share your stories, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Adrian, we've talked in the past about the role that the gray wolf plays in Wisconsin's ecosystems. Can you give us a little overview of that and how it fits into this new proposal?
Sure, and that's one of the things the department really recognizes is having a healthy, sustainable population that provides ecological benefits. And we know that within forested areas, wolves can have an effect on the deer herd, less of a suppressing effect, but moving the deer herd around more, reducing over-browsing, over-grazing that we see in the middle of wolf-pack territories, a greater diversity of wildflowers, less heavy browsing on trees and shrubs, smaller trees and shrubs. We see that there's a greater diversity of greater abundance, perhaps a red fox, because the gray fox or coyotes are being suppressed. That in turn allows for the red fox having more of an impact on small mammals, which are also major seed predators that affect the trees that are growing. So there's a lot of connections in the ecosystem by the having that healthy predator, apex predator on the landscape. There's probably a reduction in the spread of chronic wasting disease and other diseases that spread through the deer herd by having a healthy wolf population.
You mentioned coyotes. Keith from Dane County couldn't stay on the line, but was curious about the interaction between wolves and coyotes. He says he's more concerned about the threat of coyotes, wondering how their paths interact.
Wolves can have kind of a suppressing effect on coyote populations. They don't eliminate coyotes because there still are healthy coyote populations close to wolf pack areas. But what we do find is the interior wolf pack areas, there's less abundance, less presence of coyotes, and that in turn then allows red fox to do better in those places because they get suppressed by the coyotes. And red fox are major predators on small mammals, which can include mammals that spread Lyme disease or affect the seedlings that will eventually become trees in a forest. So the wolves are probably having some impact on our coyote population. But coyotes are doing very well across all of Wisconsin currently.
Go back to our callers now. Sylvia is with us in Oshkosh. Sylvia, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling about that. I have 40 acres and cabins west of here near Black River Falls. I live in Oshkosh, and I've been at my cabin for too many years, probably 60 years. And in all those years, I've never been injured by a wolf. I've seen them. I've seen them in the woods. They've never come after me. I've had bear. And I guess I heard someplace that in the state of Wisconsin, nobody's ever been killed by a black bear or a wolf. So I don't know if that's true or not. But I'm more afraid of a stray dog because when I went to school, I used to get chased every morning by dogs. So I'm not afraid of wolves. But a stray dog is too friendly. You know what I mean? They'll come up to you. And I know I've never seen any aggressive wolves on my property. I've seen them as I go back to the river when I walk, but I've only seen two come near my cabin, and one was so skinny, he looked like he was starving to death. So I don't think they get too many stray deer.
Gotcha. Sylvia, thanks for the call. Sylvia sees deer on her land, not too worried about them, it sounds like, Adrian.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like she's too concerned about wolves. And for most people, they don't need to be that concerned. And one of the things that the department did with this plan was also do a major public attitude survey. And in that attitude survey found that majority of Wisconsinites support having wolves at current or larger population levels and at current distributions across the state. So similar to Sylvia's comments that people can live with wolves. They are not a threat to human safety. There have been very rare cases of wolves attacking on people, but as Sylvia points out, the neighbor's dog is probably much more of a risk than wolves or bears would be.
Thanks for the call, Sylvia, at 800-642-1234. Russ joins us now in Verona. Russ, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I guess I'd like to suggest that maybe we could take a more enlightened approach like they do in Europe. So instead of paying off farmers for lost livestock, they get these farmers trained herd dogs, and they protect the herd animals, the cows, the sheep, or whatever, from the wolves.
Russ, thanks for the call. Adrian, apart from just compensating for lost livestock, whether it's training the dogs or other methods, are there ways to reduce those conflicts so we don't have to pay that compensation in the first place?
Well, sure, and I think it's good having both a compensation payment program, but at the same time providing mitigations to reduce losses. And the department, through USDA Wildlife Services, does provide a lot of abatement practices. There's the USDA Wildlife Services folks spend a lot of time putting fencing around farms, putting up a flattery, a special flagging device, providing guard dogs, guard animals is frequently used, especially for sheep. Guard dogs are very effective with sheep. They're probably less effective with cattle, but various types of fencing are very useful. Flattery, some changes in animal husbandry, being able to clean up some of the carcasses of dead animals can be useful. So there are non-lethal methods that help reduce wolf depredation and reduce the need to have to pay farmers.
Thanks for that call. Talking to wildlife biologist Adrian Wideven about a new DNR proposal for gray wolf management in Wisconsin. Back to your calls. Saul is with us in Stevens Point. Saul, hi.
Yeah, hi. Just wondered if there's any transmission of CWD to wolves and or coyotes.
Oh, interesting question. Chronic wasting disease, very common in deer in Wisconsin. I was wondering about that myself. Do wolves get it?
No, there has been no evidence that chronic wasting disease spreads to any of the predators that feed or scavenge on deer. So wolves have not been involved too much in chronic wasting disease because it's pretty much out of the areas where wolves are living. But coyotes have been detected to feed on infected animals and do not catch the disease. Mountain lions have fed on infected animals, and there's no evidence of them catching the disease. So it doesn't spread into the predator population.
Thanks, Saul, for the question. Will joins us now in Eau Claire. Will, hi.
Hi, guys. Quick question. In managing wolves and determining policy, in your experience and that of other biologists and program developers, have you had any misconceptions and myths, if you will, in forming your policies, that you've had to deal with, that people have had with them? So,
Adrian, myths and misconceptions you've run into about the wolves.
Well, I think there's a lot of myths that we hear of, myths such as the idea wolves are brought into Wisconsin, that wolves are going to have devastating impacts on livestock industry, that they're a threat to human safety. Those are some of the myths that we especially have to deal with. But there's also, the person talks about misconceptions and learning, and one of the things that DNR emphasizes is this an adaptive approach to wolf management, and we learn over time that things change. When I started with working with wolves in the 1990s, we thought Wisconsin could hold about 150 wolves. By the late 90s, we were guessing maybe about 500 wolves. And the current estimates are the state could probably have a healthy wolf population around 1,240 wolves. So we learn more about the wolf population as we study them. And so, yeah, there are myths both on the sides of people who have misconceptions about what wolves do and biologists as they learn more about the wolf population.
Thanks for that question. In our last minute or so, Adrian, this is a proposal. A lot of work, a lot of time went into it. That's not the end of the story, right? These are not guaranteed to become policy.
That's right. I encourage people to read the Wolf Plan and contact the DNR, submit your perspectives, your ideas on how the Wolf Plan can be improved, and support those parts of the plan that you think are good. And there are a lot of good things in this plan, so I'm hoping that a lot of people do contact the DNR and let them know that there's a lot of things in this plan they would like to see formalized. So, yes, encourage folks to check into the plan and send your comments to the DNR.
Adrian, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Adrian Weidevin is a retired forest wildlife biologist, chair of the Timberwolf Alliance Advisory Council, and assistant co-chair with the Wildlife Group for Wisconsin's Green Fire. He's with us today for a close look at a new proposed gray wolf management plan. This came from the Wisconsin DNR, and as Adrian was just saying, the DNR is now in the midst of a comment period. You can give the plan a look and give the DNR your feedback. You can also check out more on that report in our new from our news team at WPR.org. Coming up today after the news, we'll look at the role abortion played in the midterm elections and where the issue could go from here. Could look very different from state to state. And as always, you can join in with your thoughts. What do you want to see happen in Wisconsin when it comes to abortion law? You can email right now, ideas at WPR.org. That's ideas at WPR.org and share your thoughts. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up for one class of students at Lawrence University this fall, they're being evaluated on how little they can do. It's a course called Doing Nothing. We'll talk with a professor who created it with a goal of teaching students to unplug and be more present. Now, exit polling from last week's midterm elections confirmed that abortion was one of the top issues that drove voters to the polls. Voters in every state with direct ballot measures voted in favor of abortion rights, and Democrats are more broadly pointing toward the issue as a factor in some of their success on Election Day. But earlier today, President Biden said he doesn't think Democrats will end up with enough votes in Congress to pass legislation that would codify abortion access into federal law. It's clear that the issue is important to voters. Less clear what, if anything, will change nationwide and in states around the country as a result of the midterms. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How important was abortion in deciding your votes last week? How did you feel about broader support for abortion rights and votes around the country? What do you want to see happen in Wisconsin politics? Divided government again? Do you want to see the 1800s law overturned? If so, what do you want to see in its place? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Claire McKinney is an assistant professor of government at the College of William and Mary. Her research focuses on gender, politics, and reproduction in the United States. Claire, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, coming into this election, there was this expectation, you know, midterm election with a Democrat in office, the economy, lower approval ratings for the president. Republicans were expected to gain a lot of seats in the House and maybe some in the Senate. Things didn't work out that way. How big a factor, as you start to look at post-election stuff, how big a factor do you think abortion may have been in that difference?
I think when we look at the current ecosystem of American politics with political polarization really keeping people in their camps as much as it is, all you need is a 1 or 2 point swing to change something from a Republican landslide to Democrats holding on. And that's exactly what I think abortion did. Much like before Dobbs overturned Roe v. Wade, we saw ballot initiatives that were pro-life or anti-abortion driving 1 or 2 percentage points, especially in southern states. I think that's what we saw this year, especially in states that had abortion explicitly on the ballot.
One factor I've been wondering about is the role of younger women in particular. I want to play actually a question I asked a guest 2 weeks before the midterms. Here's a listen. Over the last bunch of months since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the Dobbs decision, we've seen a few elections, a referendum in Kansas, a couple of special House elections where there was kind of a hidden phenomenon, it seemed like, in the polling of younger women in particular becoming likely voters where pollsters might not have considered them that in the past. Do you think that's something that might hold in 2 weeks? Okay, that was before the election. That was kind of an unanswerable question in some ways because we didn't know. Do we have an answer to that question about younger women voters now?
I think we definitely see a solidification of younger women voters as solidly in favor of abortion rights. And so falling into the camp of Democratic candidates. And I think that it's kind of, we'll see further in the exit polls once the results can be actually analyzed. But I think that we can be relatively certain that we saw at least a more active youth participation in the election in different jurisdictions. I know that can't hold true everywhere in the nation. But again, places where you saw people really tuned in to the possibility of abortion being newly restricted in their state, or really seeing the ramifications of electing particular politicians, you'll see youth turnout much higher in this election than you did in previous ones, especially for young women.
I want to start looking at what this means for abortion laws in the country. Let's start at the federal level. It looks like the Republicans are going to have a slight edge in the House. If I'm reading that right, I'm guessing, Claire, not much is likely to change when it comes to federal law on abortion.
I think that's exactly right. So much like in the Senate, you would need a 60 vote threshold to overcome any filibuster. So we won't see any codification movement on the Senate level. And in the House, any move to restrict abortion on the federal level would meet with that same Senate filibuster. So we may see the same sort of performative politics that we've seen in the past, where people will propose bills that will probably not even get a full hearing in either the House or the Senate. But this will remain an issue fought on the battlegrounds of local and state politics.
Then at the state level, it seems like a real mixed bag. Some direct referenda changing abortion laws in some states, some state legislatures switching to a Democratic and more likely pro-choice orientation, but then states like Florida and Ohio, where it seems like the possibility is laws could move the other way. What are some of the main things you're watching for at the state level?
I think what's most important is looking at those states that tend to swing to see whether or not we see new abortion restrictions on their books. Florida has already passed a 15-week abortion ban, and I would be shocked to see any further restrictions from Florida. But I'm really interested in seeing what will happen in states like Virginia or states like Iowa, where, you know, maybe there's some possibility of movement towards Democratic or Republicans in the next election cycle, and whether or not conservative majorities in either, you know, the governor's mansion or in either of the houses of Congress will try and restrict, or will see that as electorally risky for them.
Talking to Claire McKinney from the College of William and Mary, looking at abortion and politics, the impact that abortion issues had on the midterm elections, and what the midterm elections mean for laws in states around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did this issue sway your vote one way or another? Is this an issue that brought you to the polls? Maybe for the first time, if you're one of those younger voters we were just talking about. Love to hear from you with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller now. Yordis is with us in Colfax. Yordis, hi.
Hi. I have some questions. If it is allowed that a person could have an abortion who is the victim of incest, or a woman who is raped, or something, a doctor is allowed to help a woman whose life is in danger, how is that proven to be correct in the court of law? I mean, does an incest victim have to come forward, and does that have to go through a court proceeding and a government official will allow an abortion? Is that the same with a woman? What if her rapist is unknown to her and cannot be found? Will she be shamed, and will Republicans defile her her integrity for claiming to be raped?
Yordis, I gotcha. Claire, this is a question that comes up a lot when we see these rape or incest exemptions for abortion. How does it work on that practical level that Yordis was just talking about?
I think that this has a lot to do with what context somebody is in. So for the most part, I agree with, I think, the implicit suspicion in Yordis's question, which is, what would you actually have to go through in order to prove that you were a candidate to have a legal abortion? For the most part, if we think about these laws, we can think about it really in terms of, does a physician feel comfortable providing abortion care? And so the rape and incest exceptions are ones that really are about, can a physician say, I had a legitimate belief that this person was a victim of a crime, and so this is a legitimate form of care. But in states like Texas, which still have on the books this abortion bounty law, where somebody can sue an abortion provider for providing an abortion after 6 weeks, you could see that that level of suspicion would actually have a chilling effect. So in the end, we actually don't have a system, as far as I know, in any of the states, of something like a judicial fast track for somebody who is claiming rape or incest with these very restrictive laws. And that's because prior to the Dobbs decision, we didn't have any laws that were that restrictive.
Thanks for that call, Yordis, at 800-642-1234. We've got maybe a unique position here in Wisconsin, Claire. We have this law from the early 1800s still on the books here in Wisconsin, a near total ban except in cases of a threat to the life of the mother. Divided government, a Democratic governor just reelected, a Republican legislature just reelected. They don't talk with each other that much. They don't get along that well. We may just stay with this bill and coast on the inertia. Do you see other states in Wisconsin's position, or are we unique in some ways?
I think that Wisconsin is fairly unique. Divided government and an 1800 law as the one that's in effect is one that leaves a lot of uncertainty for people. And that uncertainty certainly is the case in several other states, but in many others, you either have new restrictions or you had trigger laws in place that really affirmed anti-abortion laws as the standard. And then on the flip side, you have other states where they had on the books either constitutional protections or laws in place like New York that were very clear. And the new, obviously, referenda that we saw in California and Vermont that reaffirmed many of those statuses. I think the states that will remain the most uncertain are the ones that do have divided governorships and houses or congresses, because those are the ones where we're likely to see continued uncertainty, but nothing to the degree of Wisconsin.
We're talking to College of William and Mary government professor Claire McKinney about the role abortion played in last week's midterm elections and what those elections will mean for abortion laws in states around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where did abortion rank for you among the most important issues in this election? Was it a decisive issue in one or more of your votes? Do you think the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade in the Dobbs decision did end up helping Democrats? What do you want to see happen with federal law when it comes to abortion, with Wisconsin law when it comes to the issue, call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Claire McKinney, assistant professor of government at the College of William & Mary, where she researches politics and reproductive rights in the U.S. She's with us today to look at the issue of abortion, how it affected the midterm elections, what the results could mean for laws in states around the country. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. I want to give a listen to Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer talking about abortion and why his party exceeded expectations last week. Here's what he told MSNBC earlier today.
It stayed in the hearts of the people. You know, the commercials come on and some of them are sort of incendiary and they're the thing right at the top of people's minds when a pollster asks them about them. But abortion had always stayed as a very important issue with large numbers of people.
And Claire, there was some thought maybe up till the elections that abortion would fade in memory a little bit, I guess, since the Dobbs decision was some months ago, get bumped out by other issues. Clearly, for many people, it did persist. Why do you think that is?
I think that there are two big reasons. One is I think a lot of abortion rights and abortion rights advocates and groups were really pushing this to remain front and center in how we think about the election and the stakes of the election. Post-Dobbs, there's been a real urgency and funding and fundraising has flowed to these organizations at unprecedented rates, and they have really been front and center in getting the message out. But the other really important issue is that abortion and access to abortion is something that people live with and part of their decision-making every day. So you could imagine if you are somebody who's trying to consider whether or not you want to start a family, or somebody who's facing real material constraints on your life, that the question of whether or not you'll have access to abortion is something that affects how you think about your life every day. And so even if it's not in the headlines, if you know that you no longer have access to something that you theoretically had access to before, you may really want to act to make sure that you can transform your political and social situation in the future.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. To me, a great compromise would just be allow a woman 12 weeks to make a decision. That's plenty of time to make a decision on whether or not you're going to keep a baby or not, but also give the same right to a man. So if a man decides, I don't want to be a father within that 12 weeks, they don't have to pay child support. Make it pro-choice for men and women for the first 12 weeks.
Steve, thanks for the call. Claire, take that where you want to go with it.
I think that this is an intuition that a lot of people have. And the problem is that really we have to kind of think about why abortion is so important to determining the life chances of individuals and especially women. So while it's true that the vast majority of abortions occur in the first trimester, that is during the first, you know, prior to the first 12 weeks, there are those people who don't find out that they are pregnant until after that time. And many of those people tend to be low income or lack access to healthcare. And so those who would be most affected by an unexpected pregnancy are also those most unlikely to have the resources to be able to get prompt abortion care. And so I think that we really run up into the problem, especially when we're talking about anti-abortion states, where those who want to have abortions in the first 12 weeks either don't have access because resource constraints or don't know that they're pregnant. The second problem in thinking about kind of child support and thinking about men's obligation is, again, thinking about how reproduction has been really central to women's subordination, not just in the United States, but in many countries for centuries. And so the question is not really one only of individual obligation, but one also of political status. I think that there are a lot of complicated issues in thinking about child support and thinking about financial obligations and how those are enforced. It's by no means straightforward that the way that states enforce them now is fair or equitable, but I think tying it specifically to abortion may create a whole new can of worms that we're not quite prepared to address.
We'll go to Margie in Milwaukee now. Margie, hello.
Hi. First of all, you asked how we felt about abortion and if it made a difference. And I'm a progressive Democrat, so I wouldn't vote Democrat anyway. But the fact that the Republicans or the conservatives want to dictate a woman's right to her bodily autonomy just infuriates me. And my question is, why is it always everything's on the woman? And, you know, the woman could go to the prison. The woman gets arrested. The doctor gets arrested. What about the man? And if this needs to be, I guess I'm wondering, do we need a national DNA list of, you know, have all men at the age of 18?
Margie, thanks for the call. I want to start with Margie's first point, Claire. Margie concerned, she says, about abortion laws as an infringement on bodily autonomy. And in some of the polling out there, some of the people who are voting based in part on abortion are saying it's about abortion and about freedom, limitations on freedom, especially for women. So Margie might be onto something there.
Absolutely. I think that it is pretty clear that when people think about abortion, they do think about this in the language of freedom. And in fact, many of the abortion referenda, Michigan's, California, Vermont's, all spoke in the language of either autonomy or freedom. And so this idea that one should not be coerced in carrying a pregnancy to term, I think resonates with people and how they think about the body as a space for freedom. I think it's something that deeply resonates with American political culture more broadly.
Thanks for the call, Margie. Claire, I wanted to talk a bit about your research. You've looked at abortion and politics for decades of American history, and you have a concern, at least in write-ups I've seen on your research, that the role of medicine and doctors and medical expertise gets kind of subordinated to politics. What do you see happening?
I think that when we think about abortion, you know, a couple of different things sometimes happen. One, we often stress the health aspects first and foremost. So you can actually see this a little bit in the Montana referendum, where, you know, the question was whether or not doctors would be required to provide life-sustaining measures if a child was born alive after an abortion. And this is often a technique to, again, create a kind of chilling process around abortion. But this is all over the kind of question of we need to regulate abortion as healthcare. And that oftentimes means that we aren't actually thinking about how abortion is meaningful for how people make sense of their own reproductive lives. And so when it becomes an issue about physicians and how they ought to determine what people's lives should look like, that's another way to kind of just say expertise should determine women's lives. One of the things that I think is really exciting about the referenda that we saw in Michigan, California, and Vermont is that because they're speaking in the language of reproductive freedom more broadly, it seems like we're seeing a shift where the question of where this fits into women and other pregnant people who can get pregnant lives, we see that as a way of kind of affirming this as a central part of their political membership, of even thinking about gendered citizenship more broadly. And so we're not necessarily speaking always in the language of medicine, even though if you turned on the news, you're often seeing these stories of people denied care in cases where their lives are in danger or where we see cases of fetal non-viability, which again speaks the language of medicine, not the language of autonomy or freedom, which is where I think that the abortion discourse really ought to be.
And in just our last few moments, the midterms answered some questions. There are a lot remaining. What are you watching for next?
I'm very interested in seeing how states come to codify these referenda. I'm also interested to see whether or not Democrats will continue to push for more protections of abortion in the future, and whether or not they will really kind of flip our traditional understanding of what it means to put abortion on the ballot. In the past, it's really been about how we see anti-abortion measures really kind of pushing elections. I wonder if we're going to see that totally flip and abortion becoming just a standard bearer of progressive politics in the future.
Claire, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Claire McKinney is an assistant professor of government at the College of William and Mary. Her research focuses on gender, politics, and reproduction in the United States. She's with us today to explore what the results from midterm elections could mean for abortion in the United States at the federal level and in states around the country. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, the U.S. Supreme Court is weighing some cases related to anti-discrimination laws around the country. You can check out some of those cases and find out what's at stake, what precedents they could set, what arguments are being made on both sides. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Times change and time changes. We just adjusted our clocks over a week ago. If you didn't, you've been an hour early for a lot of stuff. Every 4 years, we have a leap year where we add a day to the year because our daily Earth calendar doesn't quite match up with the annual trip around the sun calendar. And I've mentioned a couple times in the past that scientists sometimes add a leap second. That's because the second was based on the Earth's rotation. Turns out the Earth is not a perfectly reliable clock. Now, we might be getting rid of the leap second. As reported in the New York Times, there is a super accurate atomic way to measure a second that always comes out the same, but the Earth's rotation speed varies a bit, slows down a tiny bit over time, so those two measurements get out of sync. Doesn't matter for most things, but with super accurate computer and GPS infrastructure, the difference matters. In a vote later this week, they may stop looking at the Earth's rotation, use that atomic clock, and get rid of the leap second. Will we notice? Probably not, but maybe you don't know what you got until it's gone. This is Central Time.